Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer of this program, and during this episode, we are diving into alternative forms of diplomacy, espionage, and assassination. The panel was moderated by Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, and he'll introduce the panelists shortly. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome to Alternative Forms of Diplomacy, Espionage, and Assassination, which sounds like a very exciting topic for today. This talk is brought to you by the Departments of History and Political Science, as well as the Department of English. And we have a wonderful panel with us. Starting on the far end right now, Lachlan Whalen, who is the Director of International Studies and an Associate Professor of English and Linguistics. Next to him is Anne Livshiz, an Associate Professor of History. And next to her, an Assistant Professor, Deborah Bauer from the Department of History as well. My name is Andy Downs. I'm from the Department of Political Science. We are happy to have this conversation in the basement of the library at Helmke Library on the IPFW campus, and we want to thank College Television for recording it and making it available, and of course we want to thank WBOI for making it available as well. We don't want to waste any time, get right into it, and so let's start. What is espionage? Deborah?
Espionage is one of these things that is hard to define. Almost all history books that you read about espionage start out with a bunch of paragraphs giving caveats about this is a complicated practice. And normally it gets couched within a larger system that we call intelligence. So, right, I teach a history of espionage class. Espionage is kind of the exciting title, but really we're talking about intelligence as a system. So with a definition of intelligence, there are a few things that are important to factor in. One of those is the element of secrecy. So it's information, knowledge, foreknowledge, something that you can acquire about perhaps your enemies, perhaps your friends. But the fact that this is secret knowledge makes it different from other kinds of knowledge. Another way to think about intelligence is sort of the process by which it's collected and analyzed. And this is where espionage fits in through that process. And then finally, we have the institution and the analysis of intelligence. So sometimes you say the word intelligence and you're thinking of an intelligence agency. So I know that was a broad definition, and then to kind of get into the narrow, what is espionage within that larger umbrella, I would succinctly call espionage the practice of covertly or secretly gathering information that will be used for the purpose of understanding or influencing foreign enemies.
I have been asking Deborah what her class is like, and she refuses to tell me, actually. She tells me I should have to take the class as a covert person trying to get intelligence about the class. Either of you have anything you want to add to that definition?
Lachlan? I think that's an excellent overview of it. I would maybe add as well to the general category of intelligence, certainly in a case like Northern Ireland. Part of what is definitely part of the intent is the conditioning of public opinion through that. And maybe that's the sort of application of all of the intelligence.
Yes.
But in terms of what is done with that is also an essential part of it, the conditioning of public opinion.
Right. We don't just gather it to gather it. There's a purpose to gathering it.
Right.
Sure.
Right. That's why influence within that definition,
right.
I think, is important.
Right.
Anne?
One of the paradoxes of it is that on the one hand there's obviously a very strong element of secrecy, but we also see, especially in the 20th century, there is a public public element to it as well, right? Kind of this, as the practices of espionage get more and more complex, there's also a greater publicity associated with not the specific details, but the practice overall. Especially during war, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, we see a lot of public campaigns by pretty much all the participating government that emphasize the importance of not talking publicly about things you shouldn't be talking about, right? This idea that, walls have ears, that somebody's possibly listening, possibly watching, in this very general sense. And it's interesting that even though the espionage is performed by kind of these highly trained professionals, there's a way in which the 20th century, kind of the mass century, right? There's this mass participation. You too can participate, right, by not talking about things you shouldn't be talking about, by displaying vigilance, vigilance of some sort. So there's this kind of weird, interesting participatory element to it, alongside the highly professionalized and very secret, of course, practice.
And we will eventually have some posters that we'll talk about and show folks that get at that public element. Deborah, what would you say is the earliest example of espionage?
Okay, so the earliest often people throw out the kind of prototype of the spies in the Bible is one of the earliest, by far not the earliest. The story of the spies in the Bible is Moses sending 12 spies out to spy the land of Canaan. I'm not a biblical scholar, so I will leave that on the table. But the earliest kind of actual documented example of using intelligence, using espionage as a military tactic, comes in ancient China. And you may be familiar with the name Sun Tzu, who wrote a treatise called The Art of War. He was a general, he was a military strategist, and he writes this this treatise called The Art of War, which is very much an advice manual about waging warfare for the emperor who he's serving underneath. And in this treatise, he talks about war as, you know, he refers to it as a life and death matter, that it is really the most important thing for a state. And the Art of War has several chapters, one of which is dedicated particularly to spies. And it's a short chapter. When we read it in my class, it's really only about two pages. But he describes war as very costly, both in terms of finances and in terms of human life. And so he says the smart leader, the smart emperor, will find a way to reduce the expenses. And spying is really the best way to do that. That if you can have knowledge, if you can have foreknowledge of your enemies, you can save the cost of the lives of your people, the cost of the state coffers. And so he lays out these five different types of spies, and there's the local spies, there's a category he calls moles, which are kind of traitors, really, you know, enemy spies. There's the double agents. He considers double agents the most important spies. So if you can capture an enemy spy and turn them. He has a category called doomed spy, which I think modern agencies don't like to actually hire someone as the doomed spy, even though they probably use that. And that's where you send an agent out into the enemy camp to spread misinformation, and you count on them being caught and doomed. And then there's the surviving spies, which is similar to the doomed spies, who goes out and gets caught, only actually, or doesn't get caught, comes back from the enemy camp. So this treatise comes out in about 500 BC, and I would say it's really a great example of a manual explaining why intelligence is useful, why espionage is useful, how it can serve the state, and how it can really give you a tactical advantage in any kind of war or battle that you're going to get into.
Now, we do have, I put this up here a little early, but there is an image that actually is an example, an early example of invisible ink. This particular item is, can you describe this for us?
So this comes from the American Revolution. And again, you know, when I teach my history of espionage class, I'd like to start with this document by Sun Tzu, because like I say, I think it's really interesting to see in 500 BC people thinking of something that, as Anne mentioned, we think of as a very modern tactic. So it goes to show it's not. But in terms of espionage being used through history, it really doesn't get used a lot until the quote-unquote modern era. We have Elizabethan era, where Queen Elizabeth has somebody who serves as her spy master. And then we fast forward really to the American Revolution, at least in my class. And so, you know, one of the things I was thinking about when I was putting this talk together is the techniques and the methods that were used to spy and how those have changed over time. And so I had sent Andy some images of techniques that were used during the American Revolution. And so this is one of them. And what we see here is a letter that was, you know, written that any soldier might be carrying along with him. Perhaps it's a letter home to his parents, his wife, you know, whatever. But between the lines of this ordinary letter is a secret message written in some kind of invisible ink. And generally, there were two ways that you could get the secret message out from this letter, either through heat or through some kind of acidic, you know, agent, reagent. And usually they would, during the American Revolution, you might put a little, either an F or an A somewhere in the corner of it, so that you know apply fire or apply acid.
You don't want to mix that up.
You don't want to do, you know, so if it's fire, you would hold it over over a candle. If it's acid, you use that, and that way you can get the secret message out of it. So this is one, and I don't know if you...
Well, we'll show some more later on, since I put this one up here, just to sort of bring us from Sun Tzu up to the Revolutionary War. We'll get to some others later on.
Okay.
Is there a time period, though, Lachlan and Anne, is there a time period that you think about when you hear the term espionage?
Well, certainly my own period of study is the contemporary Northern Ireland, and so that's the, probably obviously the first thing that comes to my mind. And a very different world that when most people think of espionage, it's James Bond and martinis and going to Monte Carlo. It's the diametric opposite in Northern Ireland, that when talking about intelligence assassination, it's the sort of seediest of the seedy in Northern Ireland, to the point where, for example, intelligence agencies are running double agents through places like the Kinkora Boys Home, where pedophiles are being filmed in order to influence them and to control them. We're talking about, massage parlors gathering information. We're talking sort of the seediest of the seedy, in addition to the other forms of intelligence that we're talking about here. So, but that's part and parcel of the way in which Northern Ireland was approached, that when the Troubles ignited, the person put in control of it initially was Frank Kitson, who was known for his counterinsurgency work in places like Kenya and Cyprus. And so very sort of brutal counterinsurgency methods. He published a book in 1960 called Gangs and Counter Gangs. That gives you an idea of the sort of level that we're talking about here. And that was became policy from almost the very beginning in the reignition of the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
And I think for a lot of people, when we say the Troubles, they don't necessarily realize how recently we're talking.
Right. So beginning in, you can trace them back as far as you want to 800 years or more. But when we say the Troubles, basically the sort of reignition starting in 1968 and proceeding in earnest from there until in 1998, you had the Good Friday / Belfast Agreement creating frameworks. 2005, you had the decommissioning of arms by the Irish Republican Army, and then a year or so afterwards by the Loyalist / pro-British paramilitary groups. So that's when we say the Troubles, that's the generally what we mean there, from 68 to present, really, because we're still having issues The Good Friday Agreement has not been fully implemented 20 years on. So. Right.
Well, Anne, you're not exactly right in the middle there of the time periods of revolution and earlier as well as the modern day, but what time period do you think about when you hear the term?
I want to mention both the 19th and 20th century. I think to go back to Deborah's earlier point, if you look at the history of Russia and espionage in Russia, there are some earlier examples, but it really comes into its own in the 19th century. That's where you start to see it actually be professionalized as part of the government. And it's in the 19th century that the state actually develops the secret police to monitor the various discontents within the Russian Empire. But many of them end up having to leave Russia and spend time in Europe to escape arrest. And so as a result, the investigation of Russian discontent kind of spills over into Europe and becomes an international endeavor as well. And of course, the secret police is kind of the pre-1917 secret police is usually depicted as kind of a very technically they're professionals, but that they're not particularly good at their jobs. Perhaps not ruthless enough, not brutal enough. The 20th century kind of raises the bar on that quite a bit. But essentially, they are the ones who missed, the Bolsheviks. From the point of view of allowing these discontents to overthrow the regime, they failed pretty miserably. Whereas in the 20th century, there's this really interesting. There's some continuity. Some of the people who were agents end up continuing to work for now the secret police of the Bolsheviks. There's a very famous destruction of secret police document, quote, spontaneous attack on the building that held all the secret police records. And that was one of the archives that was destroyed very, very quickly and spontaneously. And so as a result, it's the continuity, there's not kind of we still don't know for sure about a lot of the continuities, but the you know, the Soviet espionage really comes into it. It starts before World War II, but it really comes into its own during the Cold War period. And of course, the Soviet kind of efforts at espionage abroad, especially in the United States, its main rival during the Cold War. I mean, you have to kind of put an asterisk next to it in the sense, right? Because there is a certain challenge to spying in a democratic society, right? I mean, the kinds of things that an American would have to, if an American wanted to spy in the Soviet Union, they really would have to kind of ferret out various information about society and culture, whereas in a democratic society, a lot of the things are fairly open. So they can claim successes. Oh, we learned that, you know, that there's racial discrimination in America. Well, how did you learn about it? Well, you know, it was in the New York Times. But, you know, so you can claim credit for these discoveries, but ultimately, in some areas, it's not that much of a challenge, right? Whereas, of course, the, you know, various state secrets involving nuclear weapons, that was more of a challenge and certainly kind of a fairly successful one for the Soviet regime.
WBOI Presents will continue after this short break. Stay tuned.